Okay. Here's something we don't have in common. Youth. I don't have youth in common with y'all. I am quite a bit older than most everyone gathered here today, but I'll tell you something we do have in common, and that is our reason for being here. It might be easy for you to think, okay, well, Mr. Gibson, Mr. Bryan is here to teach us today. And in a manner of speaking, that's true. But I'm very sincere when I say I'm here to learn. That is very much the case. I listened very, very closely during the first session because I wanted to learn. I wanted to get better. This whole subject we're studying today is extremely important, and I'm trying to get better. I've been a Christian now for about 40 years, and I'm still working every single day to improve. Okay? So we do have that in common. So I hope that's your desire today. I kind of scanned through the crowd during that first session. I was still listening, Joshua, but I could tell all of you were paying very close attention. And I hope that that interest, that attention, will be maintained throughout the day. Okay, now, I think everybody has an outline. You don't necessarily have to follow the outline along with me. That's fine if you do. I mainly just wanted you to have that so that you can remember the points we made today, and so that perhaps you could do some further study later on. Some have already asked about that opening part, about the illustration about Kenny Moore, Coach Extraordinaire. I don't know how many of you know this, but Mr. Kenny Moore back there used to coach basketball. So, let's suppose we've got Kenny Moore, the coach, about to take his team into battle, his basketball team. He gets them together in the locker room before the game, and I mean he gives a speech for the ages. I mean, this speech is something that would put Herman Boone to shame. Anybody seen Remember the Titans? Okay. It's hard to beat Herman Boone, but I mean, Kenny Moore, at least on this day, has bested Herman Boone. So his team is fired up. They're as emotional as they've ever been. They love their coach. I mean, they've developed this bond with their coach. They love him. We might even say they love him with all their heart. And at this point, they're ready to run through a brick wall for Coach Kenny Moore. But here's the problem. Kenny has got them all motivated, but he hasn't taught them a whole lot of basketball. I mean, they've done very few drills. They haven't learned any offensive and defensive sets. I mean, they're fired up and they're ready and they're motivated and they love their coach. But they don't know what to do. And so they get out there and for a while, boy, they hang with the other team. I mean, there's so much emotion on their part that they're doing well for a period of time. Let me just cut to the chase. Let me cut to the end of the game, to that final buzzer. The score's about 100-35. Okay. Oh, they did great for a while. But boy, when that emotion wore off and it got to a point where they had to actually execute and do the things that are required to win a basketball game, they weren't ready for that. Do you see where I'm going with this? In the same way, it is certainly possible for our hearts to be on fire for the Lord. It is certainly possible for us to be just filled with zeal and yet not know what to do in order to serve the Lord. I mean, we're fired up. We're motivated. You might even say there's love in our hearts for God, and yet, as far as the details of that service and what it is precisely that we need to do to serve Him, we're deficient in that area. And so that's a problem, right? That's a problem. Basically, what I'm trying to say here at the beginning is a heart without understanding, A heart without understanding is not a whole heart. Now, that's what Joshua talked about. Serving God, loving God wholeheartedly. Well, if that function of understanding is not present, then it's not a whole heart. Let's go back to Mark 12, the passage that I believe Joshua started with today. Mark chapter 12, we won't read the entire passage, but I do want to kind of pick up with a few of the verses there. Obviously, Jesus is answering the question, as Joshua pointed out earlier, about which is the first and greatest commandment. Verse 30, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment." And then, of course, after he says this, the scribe says, okay, that's a very good answer. He's in agreement with Jesus on that. And then in verse 33, this is how the scribe replies to Jesus. "And to love him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." You see that understanding function of the heart mentioned there? One of the tasks that I have in this session today is to show you from the Scripture how vital an understanding heart is to everything we do in religion. How an understanding heart really is the foundation for everything else we do in service to God. It's even the foundation for what Joshua talked about in the very first lesson. How is it that I'm going to come to love God with all my heart and with all my soul? By understanding what is revealed about God in this book right here. The greater my understanding, the deeper my understanding, the deeper my love for God. And so, understanding is critical. The understanding of truth, the understanding of this revelation that God has given to us. Now, just to kind of get us oriented toward thinking about how vital this understanding is. Y'all are familiar with the parable of the sower, right? It's one of the most well-known parables that Jesus taught. According to the parable of the sower, who is it who patiently and consistently bears fruit? You know, some of the other ones kind of dropped off there after a while, right? You remember some of them kind of started out okay, but then ran into some problems. But who is it, according to Jesus in that parable, who patiently and consistently bears fruit? Do you remember?
Fell on the good soil.
And do you remember how he explained the good soil? Hears the word and understands it. Matthew 13, 23. Go ahead and turn there. Matthew 13 and verse 23. "But he who receives seed on the good ground is he who hears the word and understands it. Who indeed bears fruit and produces, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. If you look back a little bit further in this chapter, look to verse 15, where he's explaining the reason why he teaches in parables. In verse 15, "For the hearts of this people have grown dull, their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them." So do you see how this function of understanding is made vital by Jesus here? That understanding function of the heart is critical. And without it, it's not a whole heart. He says if people would understand, if they would really listen, if they would really listen with a soft heart and understand what I'm saying, then they would turn. They would turn to me and they would serve me. They would love me if they would hear with this soft heart and understand what I'm saying to them. According to 1 Corinthians 14, and I know this is kind of throwing this out at you and maybe it's something you hadn't studied at least recently, but according to 1 Corinthians 14, what is the key to effective God-pleasing worship? Is it that we've all been worked into a frenzy? Is that the indication of God-pleasing worship, that everybody is fired up, that everybody's almost into a frenzy? Is that the way 1 Corinthians 14 explains it? I study and typically preach from the New King James Version. In the New King James Version, in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, there's a word that appears 9 times in that chapter, or at least a form of the word. And that word is understanding. 9 times in 1 Corinthians 14, in the context of our assembly worship, he uses the word understanding. Understanding of truth. Understanding of truth is the key to effective, God-pleasing worship. Now, that's not the way everybody thinks, okay? We're going to talk a little bit more about this later on, but there's a tendency on the part of many people to want to change what God has revealed to us about the manner in which we should worship. And the reason they want to change it is they figure if we can doctor it a little bit, if we can add a little bit of this or take a little bit of that away, then we can generate more emotion. We can get everybody more fired up. Well, here's the thing. We can do exactly what God has told us to do in our worship. We can limit ourselves to what He has authorized, and we can still be emotional. The understanding, though, has got to come first. Okay? The understanding of truth. We cannot put feelings ahead of truth. Everybody understand that? We cannot put feelings ahead of that. Understanding is the key. How do we know for sure that we're pleasing to the Lord? Let's go to 1 John. I appreciated so much Joshua's use of the various passages from 1 John earlier. But look in 1 John chapter 2. And I won't even tell you the verse right now. This is probably familiar to some of you. In one of the verses there in chapter 2, John says, "Now by this we know that we know Him if we are sincere." Is that the answer? "By this we know that we know Him if we are fired up for Him." Is that what he says? What does he say? "Now by this we know that we know Him" what? Verse 3. "If we keep His commandments." It's a little bit more objective, isn't it, than "I've got this burning desire inside of me. I know for sure that I'm right with the Lord. I can just feel it. How can I feel this way? How can I be this fired up in what I'm doing still be wrong? There's no way you can tell me that I'm wrong because of the way I feel." "Now by this we know that we know Him if we keep His commandments." So again, just here in the beginning, I'm trying to get us to see how understanding, the understanding of truth, really is vital to everything that we do. One of the reasons why this is so important, and I've kind of already touched on this, and I think this is kind of what Kenny was alluding to in his introductory remarks, There's always been a tendency on the part of religious people to put feelings ahead of understanding. Okay. I sense that there's even a bigger problem with it right now than I have seen in my last 20, 30 years or so. To some people, emotions trump truth. I mean, that's just a fact. A lot of people feel like emotions trump truth. They're more important than truth. Why should we worry about the details? It's more about how we feel, isn't it? Well, that being the case, what I want to do really in the remainder of the lesson today is I want us to talk about the relationship between the proper understanding of truth and our emotions or our feelings. It's very important that we understand that scriptural relationship, again, as it's described here in this revelation. I'm going to make three major points about that, and each one of these will be broken down in some more detail. Number one, the truth, provided we have a good understanding of it, will produce a wide array of emotions. Can you name me some? If I'm studying the Bible and I have a good understanding of the truth that's presented in it, can you tell me some emotions that will be generated by that? Thankfulness? Absolutely. What else? Don't you think your heart will be filled with gratitude the more you learn about God and His love for us? What else? What other emotions will you experience?
Joy.
Joy, absolutely. One of the reasons John wrote that epistle that Joshua referred to throughout his lesson and that I just referred to a few minutes ago, one of the reasons he wrote it according to chapter 1 and verse 4 is that our joy might be full. You know, when I read that, you know what that tells me? When I'm reading this book, I'm going to look for things that increase my joy. Okay? And I found them. There's a bunch of them in there. What else? What other emotions? I'm sorry? Fear. Absolutely. I tell you what, you study some of those stories in the Old Testament, and boy, they'll strike fear in your hearts. And there's plenty of reason in the New Testament as well. Our God is a consuming fire. He warns us there in Hebrews chapter 10 about, you know, after we have learned the truth and we sin willfully, those terrible things that we've done, we've insulted the Spirit of grace. And he talks about this, how it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. All that stuff strikes fear in us. And there's a bunch of other emotions, right?
Sadness,
grief. Absolutely. Think about the life of Jesus. Do we see a wide array of emotions in the life of Jesus? Y'all have read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? You know his life very well. His life was marked by episodes of different emotional feelings that he had. How about Paul? Since he's the apostle we probably know the most about, he wrote so much of the New Testament, we get insight into his heart in so many of the letters that he wrote. Did Paul experience a wide range of emotions? Sure he did. Yeah. When I look at Jesus in some of the various passages that describe his emotion, and when I look at Paul and the emotions he experienced in those various passages, again, it's clear to me that the deepest emotions are felt by those who have the deepest understanding of truth. Let me give you an example. Turn to 2 Corinthians 2 in verse 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 4. Here's sort of somewhat of an emotional outpouring from Paul. 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 4. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote to you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have so abundantly for you. You think you could ever write a letter like that to a person or maybe to a group of people and be filled with the same kind of emotions that Paul had? Are you familiar with 1 Corinthians? You know why he was filled with so much emotion? They had a lot of problems in that church, right? And he wrote to them hoping to correct those problems, hoping to get them to repent. He said, I'm going to tell you, when I wrote that letter, there was so much anguish in my heart. And I didn't do it just to make you mad or to make you upset. I wanted you to know the love which I have so abundantly for you. You know how you have that abundant love for people? You know how you feel that same anguish and affliction of heart? Is you study this book and you get thoroughly acquainted with it. With its teachings, with its commandments, with its principles, with its stories. And the more you learn truth, the deeper your emotions become. Okay. So, don't ever be ashamed of the genuine emotions which spring from an understanding of truth. I am not at all in favor of manufacturing emotion. You know, people will say, well, you know, when we get to worship, why don't we dim the lights? And why don't we all get in a circle? And why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? They've got all these little cute little ways of manufacturing emotion. You don't have to manufacture it. Truth, properly understood, will produce a wide array of very genuine, very deep emotions. All right, here's major point number two. The understanding of truth also serves to regulate our emotions. We're going to talk about four different ways that the understanding of truth regulates our emotions. First of all, it prevents wild swings of emotion. Emotions can be pretty fickle, right? You remember Paul and Barnabas in Acts chapter 14 in the city of Lystra? You remember how Paul and Barnabas were treated by the people there in Lystra? What did they call Paul and Barnabas? Called them gods, right? Were ready to sacrifice to them. What did they eventually do? Or not too long after they called them gods and were ready to sacrifice to them, not very long after that, what did they do to Paul? They stoned him. So they went from, you are a great God, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of men, they can't even hardly keep the people from sacrificing to them. They go from that wild emotion to the other extreme of actually stoning Paul. Remember in Galatians chapter 4, Paul talked about the manner in which those brethren had received him. He says, you received me as an angel of God. He said, if it would have been possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. Now what was Paul to them? He was an enemy. You see the wild swings of emotion? You know what truth does? Truth prevents these wild swings of emotion. You don't feel one way, one minute, and then entirely different the next. Have you ever known Christians like that? Okay. Really fired up one minute, you know, and it seems like everything's going well for them. They're very happy. They're very supportive of the elders, very supportive of the preacher. What can we do to help? And then the next minute, they're as mad as they can be and they're causing all kinds of problems. And it's like, well, what happened to them? You know what steadies us? You know what steadies us and keeps us from going from one extreme to the other? The understanding of truth. Okay. It prevents these wild swings. A second way that understanding regulates our emotions is it keeps these emotions from being misdirected. It instead directs our emotions in keeping with truth. In Acts 7, in verse 41, Stephen there is talking about what the Israelites did at Mount Sinai. And it says they rejoiced in the work of their own hands. What was it that they had done with their own hands? What had they made? They'd made a golden calf. Was that pleasing to God? No, not at all. But were they happy about it? Sure, it says they rejoiced in the work of their own hands. Do you think that's going on in religion any today? Is there a lot being done in religion today that is the product of man's thinking rather than God's? Sure. But people are rejoicing in it, right? They think it's the most wonderful thing in the world. And they would have you to believe that it's the most wonderful thing in the world. They are, in a sense, rejoicing in the work of their own hands. Joshua mentioned earlier 1 Corinthians 13 and the way love is supposed to act. Remember what love does not do? It rejoices in the truth, but it does not rejoice in what? What's the opposite of truth? It does not rejoice in iniquity. Love does not rejoice in iniquity. I can't get happy about sin. Even if it looks like whatever it is that I'm doing is doing some good, even if it looks like what I'm doing is getting people all fired up, if it's sin, I don't rejoice in it. Okay. And see, an understanding of truth makes sure that my emotions are channeled in the proper way. That my emotions are channeled in a way that's keeping or in keeping with truth. Kind of mentioned this sort of saying a little bit earlier today, but the basic mantra of some people is, how can this be so wrong when it feels so good? Now, people may not say it quite that brazenly, but that's really the attitude behind it. In James chapter 4, James was addressing some of his very worldly-minded readers. And they were a little bit too happy about some things that they should not have been so happy about. And here's what he tells them in verse 9. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. The things that you're laughing about, you really should be mourning about them. The things that you're joyous about, you really ought to be gloomy about those things. I know that these emotions are deep, and I know that you feel them, but they're wrong. You see what I'm talking about? Truth keeps our emotions in harmony with truth. Okay. That understanding is so critical. John, writing there in 3 John, says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in truth. All right, young ladies, let me ask you a question real quick before we move on. Which would you rather have? I know some of you are still very much eligible. You're still looking for that man of your dreams. Which would you rather have? Truth that God has preserved for us in this book. Does that sound like a pretty good plan? Wouldn't you rather have somebody like that? Don't you think you can put more trust in a young man like that? Okay. And know that that young man is going to keep you on the right path and is going to ultimately help lead you to heaven. Yes, you want an emotional man. You want somebody who cares deeply about you and is not afraid to express those deep feelings for you. But you want those deep feelings to be in harmony with what's revealed here. That's the kind of man that you're looking for. And we can turn the tables, of course, and look at it from the other direction, too. All right. A third way that understanding can regulate our emotions It keeps our emotions under control. There are some emotions which are legitimate, except when they get out of control. Can you give me an example? Give me a legitimate emotion that we can express that becomes wrong when it gets out of control, when we take it too far.
Anger.
Yeah, that's what I've got on my sheet. Absolutely. Yeah. Is there such thing as righteous anger? Do we see, we talked earlier about in the life of Jesus, do we see episodes of Jesus showing anger? Oh yeah, absolutely. We talked about that abundant love that Paul had earlier. We'll give you the flip side of that. In 2 Corinthians 11, this has always struck me, Paul says, who is made to be weak? Or who is made to stumble, and I do not burn with indignation. Now, you know what he's talking about in that context? He's talking about false teachers who were leading his dearly beloved brethren away from the truth. He says, when I see you stumble, when I see you made weak, and I think about these people who had this influence on you, I burn with indignation. I'm mad about that. I'm going to tell you, you don't feel that way until you get thoroughly acquainted with this book. There are some people to whom false doctrine means nothing. It's just like, okay, that's what he believes, no big deal. Okay, he may teach that and he may lead some people astray. I mean, we're all trying to head to the same. I mean, it's just no big deal to some people. You know who it is a big deal to? Those who have a profound understanding of truth, like Paul. When you have a profound understanding of truth, you burn with indignation. But now at the same time, anger can get out of control, right? One of the works of the flesh, in Galatians chapter 5, I think this is the way the New King James words it, outburst of wrath. That's one of the works of the flesh, outburst of wrath. What is it that moderates our emotions? That keeps our emotions under control. What is it that keeps me from getting too angry and making sure that I'm angry at the right things? Understanding of truth. So again, you see how it regulates. All right, one other way, and this is extremely important. One other way that the understanding of truth regulates our emotions is it produces more settled emotions. I kind of got into this a little bit a few minutes ago. How many of you, well, first of all, raise your hand if you have known of some Christian, older or younger, who has gone astray, who has gone back out into the world. Raise your hand if you know somebody right now. Okay. Now, I don't know, obviously, about the people that you have reference to, but could it be that at least in some of those cases that they really appeared at least at one time to be pretty fired up, to be enthusiastic? Would you say that was the case, at least with some of them that you knew? You know, from all appearances, they were pretty fired up, enthusiastic about their service. But for some reason, they fell away. What the truth does, and I'm not saying that the truth will not produce some occasional outpourings of emotion, but more than anything else, what the truth does is produce what we might call more settled emotions. The ones that don't wax and wane. The ones that stick with us. The kind that produce steadfast, immovable Christians. Isn't that what Paul wrote to the brethren in Corinth? Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. You know, I know some Christians like that. And some of those Christians that I know who are like that, you don't see a lot of outpourings from them. In other words, how they feel emotionally is not always real visible. In fact, some real critically minded Christians might even look at them and say, you know, I don't see much heart in them. No, what you're not seeing is them, you know, overflowing with it, you know. There's still emotion there. And that emotion may very well be very deep. But again, it's not the up and down sort of thing. It's a settled kind of emotion. John 15 and verse 11, Jesus said, "These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full." There are some Christians for whom that joy stays with them. They're not rejoicing one minute and then the very next day they're about as gloomy as one can possibly be. They rejoice today. They rejoice tomorrow. They rejoice the next day. They rejoice every day of the week. You say, now wait a minute, aren't there times of sorrow in there? Sure there are. But in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 10, when Paul was describing his own experience and the experience of the other apostles, this is a great statement. He said, "As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing." Think about that now. As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. In other words, even in times of sorrow, we can still rejoice. That's the kind of joy that remains in people. It causes them to be steadfast. Joshua mentioned earlier, gratitude is one of those emotions. How often are we to give thanks, according to Ephesians 5:20 and other passages? How often are we to give thanks? 5 days a week, right? Maybe one time a day. Is that how often? Always. Ephesians 5:20. Give thanks always. So we're talking about the truth producing the kind of gratitude that enables us to do that. Again, you'll have some Christians who every great now and then they'll be so overcome with emotion, "I just want to thank God for what He has done for me." And that's fine. But yet, they may go for a period of time where, you know, that expression of gratitude is almost absent. You see what we mean by the more settled emotions that the truth produces? A gratitude that enables us to give thanks always. A joy that sticks with us even in times of sorrow. Fear was mentioned earlier as one of those emotions. A fear that stays with us, that causes us to steer away from evil. What is it Proverbs 8 and verse 13 says? The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Well, again, that's something that just stays with us. So, again, it's very important that we see how truth regulates our emotions. Now, third major point about the understanding of truth. The understanding of truth will root out certain emotions. Some that have no place in the life of a Christian. Can you tell me an emotion that has no place in the life of a Christian? It just ought to be eliminated completely. I'm sorry? Jealousy? Sure, that's great. And the one that's kind of a twin of jealousy would be what? Envy, right? Envy, jealousy. How about bitterness? You know any Christians who are bitter? Unfortunately, I know a few, okay? Those have no place in the life of a Christian. You know what the truth does? It uproots those. And you know how it does it, specifically in the case of the ones that we just mentioned? Did Jesus have anything to say about self-denial? Is that it's pretty emphasized New Testament principle, isn't it? If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Joshua mentioned earlier the Luke 14 passage, if anyone does not hate his father and brother and mother and sister, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. So what's at the root of envy and jealousy and bitterness? What's at the root of those sins? I'm pointing to it. Self. self-centeredness. You cannot properly understand truth and properly put that truth into action and still feel bitterness and envy and jealousy. Once that love of self has been removed. How about Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4? Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. And then who does he go on to give as the ultimate example of someone who did that? Who does he give as an example? In Philippians 2. Jesus Christ, right. Okay. All right. Just about to the end here. Let me give you two warnings, kind of based on everything that we've said, and these are on your handout as well. Resist any and all efforts to change God's plan for any reason, including the desire to generate more emotion. You know what we all need really more than anything else? We need conviction. We need conviction of truth. Now, do you think that conviction will produce emotion? Absolutely. Absolutely. So, again, don't try to change anything about God's will to make you feel better. You get in line with what God has said to do, and the emotions or the feelings will come. Second warning, don't judge others to be unemotional or lacking in spirituality simply because they show very few outward displays of emotion. There's a far better way to judge the depth of one's faith and love and their spirituality in general, and that's by their consistent service to the Lord. And again, I know a lot of very fine Christians like that. I see a lot of, in some cases, young Christians. It's not always young Christians. But I see them criticizing some of their older brethren. They'll say, they ain't got any passion. I'm sick and tired of all these passionless brethren. Be careful about going there. Be careful about going there. I don't know if you know that or not, really. Okay. Again, from your young eyes, from your young perspective, you're not seeing that overflowing emotion sometimes. Look, in some cases, they may be dead, okay? They may be. But I'm just saying that's an awful hard thing to judge. But don't you think for someone to consistently serve the Lord for many, many years, don't you think there have to be some emotions deeply rooted in that person for them to be able to do it for that long and to do it for that well, or do it that well? I believe so. So be careful about judging those people. In conclusion, Jesus said in John 6 and verse 38, "For I have come down from heaven to do what feels best to me." Is that what Jesus said? "I have come down from heaven to do what will fire me up and get others fired up too." Is that what Jesus said? Can anybody complete that statement for me? What did he say?
To do not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me.
Exactly. Very good. I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. You're here to do his will, okay? To discover his will. Don't worry. Diligent study of God's word, detailed study of God's word, that's not going to lead to dead religion, okay? It's going to lead to something far from that, okay? I believe you'll be pleasantly surprised by the deep emotions, the settled deep emotions you experience the more you come to understand truth. Thank you so much for your good attention.